So I want to welcome you to this Sunday, this 8th day of March 2026. And my name is Nana. I'm one of the Sangha members here, and I will be holding space today, going through our sit and just give you a sense of what to expect today. For the next 30 or so minutes, we'll have a brief sit, which will be kicked off with one bell and then ended with three rings of the bell. And then we'll get into the discussion on or around Bhavata. There'll be a mini talk on joy, which is the theme for the month of March. Joy as the theme, the theme from our speaking series, which is focused on transcendental dependent origination. And so today the focus will be on joy. But I know joy may sound a little Pollyanna-ish considering. All things considered, let me say that. And so after the talk around 10:30, there'll be a short break and then a discussion, which will take us to about 11-ish. And then we'll open it up for a whole group discussion and with brief announcements and some merit. And so that's basically what you can expect for the day today. So, yes. So we're going to jump right in into the talk. And as I mentioned in the beginning, the focus today is on joy. Joy, that's the third link in transcendental dependent origination, starting from dukkha, faith, and now joy. And I want to start before getting to the talk of what the Buddha said, grounding ourselves and what the Buddha said. I want to read an email to you that I received on Wednesday of the past week that brought me a lot of joy. And this is from someone I spoke to via Zoom once. They went through tremendous trouble having this, they reached out to me to talk about the Dharma and other topics. And they went through tremendous efforts going through VPNs and the such, just to make this Zoom call. And this is what they sent me on Wednesday. Dear Nana, as I'm writing to you, I am barely connected to the internet and might lose access again. I might lose access again soon. So please don't worry if I stop responding. The war has been going on since Saturday, and I have witnessed four missiles hit a place near me. My head still rings. Dot, 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 dot. I am fully grounded in Mother Earth and arms open to the skies, as I am certain help is here around us. Dot, dot, dot. You spoke to me about the Iranian national karma, and I keep thinking about our conversation. Since the protests in January and now the war, I have changed so much. I am witnessing the full force of narcissism play out in front of me, take lives and ultimately destroy itself. And this is the last line that got me. Please know that we are here in Iran, ready to help build a new world, and we are awake. Please know that we are here in Iran, ready to help build a new world. And we are awake. Much love, Faiza. This is from a real person I've never met. Spoke to only once for 30 minutes because of the Dharma. So today I want to explore one of the most subtle and revolutionary teachings in early Buddhism, which is joy as a condition for awakening. Joy as a condition for awakening. And specifically, the Buddha taught that liberation unfolds according to specific conditions, lawful conditions. But the Buddha also revealed that there are two different chains of dependent origination. The first chain, which we went through a few years ago, describes how suffering perpetuates suffering. The second, which is what we're focused on this year, is how suffering, or as Nana likes to say in the contemporized version, trauma is the condition for liberation. And this is what's described, as we all know, in the Upanishad Sutta, where the Buddha specifically said the following: suffering is the supporting condition for faith. Faith is the supporting condition for joy this month. Joy is the supporting condition for rapture. And rapture is the supporting condition for tranquility. And tranquility, the supporting condition for happiness. And happiness is the supporting condition for concentration. And concentration is the supporting condition for knowledge and vision of things as they really are. But importantly, in January, the focus was on dukkha as the supporting condition for faith. Then in February, we focused on faith as the supporting condition for joy. So this month, we'll focus on joy based on faith, which leads to rapture. And it tells us that awakening does not begin with bliss. Look around us. It begins with dukkha. So if you're seeing a lot of dukkha around you, it's fertile ground for awakening, individual awakening, and mass awakening. So I want to go into what the Buddha said about joy, what it means, what joy really means, how it arises, what gets in the way in our contemporary lives, and why joy is indispensable for awakening. So again, in the sutta we just listened to, the Buddha described the sequence that transforms suffering into liberation, starting with dukkha, which is not just pain, but rather the unsatisfactory nature of our conditioned existence. And the world as it is today is the peak manifestation of our conditioned existence. It is, collectively. So when families were disagreeing with families and making fun of each other, it was all fun and good on social media, not realizing it was the fertile ground for peak hate, which is what we're seeing everywhere. Our judgments of other people, our projection of our trauma onto other people, our need to dominate and control other people, rather than looking at ourselves. So instead of trying to escape suffering that we should become, if it's available to us, curious about our suffering. Because it is this curiosity that opens the door to faith. Why am I acting like this? Why do I engage like this? Why am I triggered in this way? Why am I sad? Why am I depressed? And faith, sadha, meaning resting in what is true, is not blind belief. It's the confidence that is born from direct experience. And no one can tell you what your experience is because you're your own authority. That's why we bristle when we hear someone projecting their authority onto us. I know I do. Bante Gunaratana of the Bhavanas Society in West Virginia described this as the heart's recognition that Dharma works. And when this recognition appears, the mind experiences relief, and that relief becomes joy. You're proving it to yourself. You're your own scientist. I'm my own scientist. So then I thought about the etymology of the word joy. Because frankly, if I may ask you, who feels joy is Pollyanna-ish and not rooted in reality? Or who bristles at hearing the word joy, joy, joy? Anyone, you can just raise your hand if, or unmute. Ah, Linda, Mark, Kamal, Charles. Okay, here you go, Kamal. Here you go, Linda. Here you go, Charles, Mark. The English word joy is ambiguous. But in Buddhist psychology, Mark, the word translated as joy refers primarily to two distinct Pali terms, pamoja and piti. Pamoja. Now, these are often conflated in translation, but they refer to different stages of the awakening process. So, pamoja, the joy described in the transcendental chain, pamoja means gladness. Gladness. It means an uplift of the mind. Charles, Mark, Linda. It means moral exhilaration. The kind of moral exhilaration that comes from the perfume of blamelessness, doing no harm, from right view and right intention. So you never have to look over your shoulder. You never have to keep track. You don't have to have a memory if you're telling the truth. Inner brightness also describes this pamoja joy, gladness, uplift of the mind, or as Bob Marley would say, emancipate yourself from mental slavery, moral exhilaration, and inner brightness. And the word derives from the root mud, meaning to be glad or delighted. Pamoja. So pamoja is not excitement. Ha Pamoja, joy, is the mind brightening when it recognizes the possibility of liberation right here, right now. Charlotte, I'm looking at you. Right here, right now, the mind brightening feel when it recognizes the possibility of liberation. That brings me joy, just like dancing brings me joy. And I dance a lot, especially to loud reggae music. Try it or don't. Or you could Sufi dance and ask Judith to teach you how to do that. Mahasi Sayadaw, Linda, I know you love the Sayadaws, wrote that when practitioners begin to see impermanence clearly, a lightness appears in the mind, and that lightness is pamoja. What are you carrying that is heavy? Ask yourself that, Kamal. And if you ask yourself, Kamal, you never have to look over your left shoulder. Then piti, which is what comes next month, is the next stage, often translated as rapture. But it's important to talk about this in the context of joy because there are different flavors of joy. That if pamoja is emotional uplift, then piti is energetic joy. Wow, this is really happening. It's the kind of thing when you do the biomimicry, you smile at somebody and they smile back. Biomimicry, you know, it works. Especially when you're doing a social experiment yourself. Or you're kind to people, let them cross the street and don't drive past them and they wave thank you. It's an exchange of joy. Even if they don't, knowing that you chose to be kind brings an inner joy. So in the Visuddhimagga, talking about Buddhist psychology, describe 5 degrees of pity, this energetic rapture, which is a minor thrill, momentary flashes. I'm sure some of you have experienced this, wave-like surges, maybe even a bodily uplift, all these tingling sensations, which make you feel this bliss, this jhanic bliss, or just the bliss of being happy, I suppose. So pity is frequently experienced in meditation as tingling, waves of energy. We're talking about energy not that long ago, or warmth in the body. Then there's sukha, which comes after a rapture. And sukha, the opposite of dukkha, is deeper than pity. It is stable contentment. And pity excites the nervous system, whereas sukha soothes it. Joy energizes the mind, tranquility stabilizes it, and makes concentration possible. It's like seeing a monk or a person in meditative repose in the middle of abandoned ruins or bombed out buildings. How do you find peace in that place as a visual? So I want to talk about the radical difference between Buddhist joy and secular joy. Because modern culture defines joy as pleasure or excitement, whereas the Buddha meant something entirely different. So we know that secular joy depends on external circumstances, success, relationships, entertainment, possessions, whereas Buddhist joy arises from understanding reality. This sort of joy that arises when the mind recognizes suffering can't end. Suffering can't end. I don't have to be in this abusive relationship anymore. I can say no. I can choose to say no. I don't have to keep over-functioning for these people. I can say no. I don't have to say sorry when I've done nothing wrong just because it makes the powerful person feel better. I can refuse from a wholesome perspective, a skillful perspective. And Bhante Buddharakita, who precepted me, I believe precepted Thera as well, said, joy is the fragrance of a mind turning toward liberation. So I want to ask you to reflect on this. What is in the way of your own manifestation of joy, Janelle? Julie, what is in the way of your own manifestation of joy in your lived experience today? Diana. So at first, this teaching seems paradoxical. At least to me, it does. In the same way, acceptance, just accept, seem sort of passive and counterintuitive. Accept. What is that? How could joy arise from suffering? But the Buddha's insight is profound. Just like the woman from Iran said, there are missiles all over, but my hands are open to the sky. We are here, awake and ready to usher in a new earth. Boom. Today, we are awake. Boom. Not afraid. Boom. Because when suffering is understood clearly, it produces insight. That's the insight she offered, which brought me joy. Because she shared her joy. Insight produces confidence, and that confidence produces joy. The same insight that produced the awareness that I had to leave my second marriage with a little daughter who wasn't 1 year old yet. Because I had to choose joy. I had to get away from my own delusions, and there was great suffering in that. But the insight from realizing I couldn't continue on this pattern produced confidence in me. A confidence that doesn't need to be loud. That doesn't need to be domineering or dominate, even though I'm an Aries. So you realize that suffering is not permanent. That this suffering that I'm experiencing has a cause. And whatever is dependently originated, whatever has a cause, can cease. Whatever arises, falls. This is physics. So, how is joy an antidote to spiritual bypasses? Because we know in modern spiritual culture, many of us, including me, attempt to bypass suffering and jump directly to bliss. This is what in psychology is known as spiritual bypassing, or not doing the shadow work, or what Carl Jung calls individuation. But the Buddha's path does the opposite, noting that the path begins with suffering. First noble truth, first link in the transcendental dependent origination, dukkha. And only when suffering is fully felt and understood does joy arise. That's why some of the kindest people who've done very kind things from humanity mostly came from deep suffering and experienced deep suffering. Pick your favorite moral person, including the Buddha themselves. So the point is that only when suffering is fully felt and understood does joy arise. This means joy leads to embodiment, not escape. Embodiment, or what you would call in therapeutic societies, is somatic experiencing. Joy is the nervous system recognizing safety and possibility, or what psychologists call polyvagal theory, that heaven and hell, excuse me, are in your nervous system. That's polyvagal theory. So as I come to the end of this, we know that there are obstacles to experiencing joy. And the Buddha called these the three poisons: greed, aversion, and delusion. Greed, lobha, is this constantly pushing and oriented towards this future. Realizing modern consumer culture amplifies this endlessly, which is why this economy is based on 80% consumer spending. And how do you get 80% consumer spending? You create greed and envy through advertisement. That's why the great economists, including Milton Friedman, said there is no capitalism without greed and envy. Oh, you went to Santorini? I'm going to the Amalfi Coast. Oh, you went on a 30-day retreat? I did a year long. Oh, you did that, and I know what this, and you know that. What is that? More suffering. Aversion. And aversion manifests as anger, resentment, judgment. And a mind filled with aversion contracts. Joy requires openness. Then delusion, which is ignorance about the nature of reality. When the mind understands impermanence and non-self, it clings to what cannot be held, and clinging blocks joy. I had a good time yesterday. Am I going to have a good time today? Oh, I heard Ajahn so-and-so talk last week. It's going to be good this week too. So mindlessness is the modern impediment, because a concentrated mind cannot be controlled. A joyful mind cannot be manipulated. And we know that our modern milieu fragments our attention. Constant stimulation from good and bad information creates a mind that is unsettled. Joy requires stillness. It is subtle. And when the mind is scattered, joy cannot be recognized. Now we know that the Buddha emphasized joy because at the time, there were severe ascetic practices. There was also a lot of ritual sacrifice. Many believed in the Brahminical way of thinking that liberation required self-punishment. And the Buddha rejected these views. That's why he taught the middle way. And the same thing happens today. We have political polarization. It's even sort of anathema and pithy to even say that. That ship has sailed, right? It's now individual splits. The great split, as some call it, the great separation, has already happened. The projection of economic precarity, you've heard about gas prices potentially going up if they haven't gone up already, produces chronic stress. Social fragmentation creates loneliness. We know about the loneliness epidemic from the last Surgeon General. Technological overstimulation fragments attention. And trauma saturates modern life from parent to child, person to person. So these conditions make the cultivation of joy more difficult, yet more necessary. So we know that as I wind down here, joy energizes practice, and joy therefore counteracts sloth and discouragement. Joy stabilizes attention, and when a mind experiences joy, concentration deepens naturally. Joy, importantly, protects against despair. You cannot be desperate when you're joyful. You cannot be afraid when you're grateful. So joy reminds us why this Buddha Dharma matters. Joy is pivotal to awakening. So I want to end by reading this email to you one more time. Dear person, as I'm writing to you, I am barely connected to the internet and might lose access again soon. So please do not worry if I stop responding. The war has been going on since Saturday, and I've witnessed four missiles hit a place near me. My head still rings. I am fully grounded in Mother Earth and arms open to the skies as I'm certain help is all around us. And arms open to the skies, the same skies raining missiles. Those are my words. I'm certain here's help is around us. You spoke to me about the Iranian national karma, and I keep thinking about our conversation. Since the protests in January and now the war, I have changed so much. I am witnessing the full force of narcissism play out in front of me, take lives, and ultimately destroy itself. And then my favorite part, please know that we are here in Iran, ready to help build a new world. And we are awake. Much love, Pfizer. Want to thank you for your rapt attention, your energy. And we're going to open it up for open discussion with a few pointers that we speak from our perspectives. All perspectives are welcome, and that we don't take it upon ourselves to offer advice or correct or comment on what other people said, and that we do it respectfully in the Dharma. Suze, please.
I once heard Thich Nhat Hanh responding to a question that was the Vietnam War and the occupation by France and the whole history, was that the Vietnamese karma? And he responded that it was the human karma, that we have been hurting each other, objectifying each other, separating, living in ignorance, and that, and so I bristled a little with Iranian karma. I mean, I have no idea. I mean, this is just a response, not coming from knowledge about karma, but the Thich Nhat Hanh's response of helping us see the species karma, you know, historical, of hurting each other. And we also have that other karma of caring for each other, which your person in Iran speaks to as well. Anyway, thank you, Nana.
Yeah, well said, Suze. Well said. Well said. Well said. You know, it's all a reflection. Relationships with others are just reflections of where we are, and we can get into the fractals. But you said it so well. You said it so well. Julie, please jump in.
Hi, Nana. Thanks for the talk. That was really great. I was wondering, as someone who still, after all these years, is wrestling, I think, a little bit with technique around digging in some of the deep-seated dukkha, the trauma-based dukkha. And I was wondering if you could say a word about that.
Ah, that's really powerful. So perhaps in my experience, if you can imagine me lying on a yoga mat, crying and with phlegm everywhere, looking at the ceiling and say, how did I get here? I'm just giving you a visual, Julie. How did I get here? Or sitting at Gordon Gardens Beach and thinking about my life, like, oh my goodness, well, why did that happen? And why were they so mean? I'm 6'5". And I'm sitting at Gordon Gardens crying, grieving, metabolizing. Then I look at my second marriage and I realize, oh my goodness, you overlooked the red flags. You did. They were right there. But because of your trauma, your abandonment issues, your attachment issues, and your need to be a people pleaser is why you overlooked it. Ah, people pleaser. Where did that come from? And over, oh, when I was 17, my father said I would be a failure. Ah. Oh, that's where my strength comes from. But that's why I also overcompensated. Ah, yikes. This doesn't feel good. And it wasn't about blaming myself, Julie. It's about the end of delusion, which was the Dharma. It was the end of me deluding myself. And it was the desire to look at what I thought was a cobra, as we've all heard, and realize that the cobra that I thought was just a black rope. So we're not afraid of other people. We're not even afraid of difficult situations outside. We are most afraid of how we would feel if we were to look into our shadows. We're not afraid of the shadows. We are afraid of how we feel. That's why a lot of us bypass or numb or look the other way. And the simple question Julia asks is, why do I do that? Or why does this keep happening? What is my part in this tango? Because it takes two to tango. One hand can't clap. So when I start to ask the question, what's my part in this? Because one hand can't clap, right? Victim or victor, what's this recurring theme? When I started to look at myself, not as a victim, but to understand the root cause of where my delusions and my anger and my aversiveness came from, and why I thought over-functioning as an empath would make everybody kinder, which is the same delusion, why I kept doing that. It's not until I started to look at that I lost the fear of external validation. Right, and that was the beginning of cracking this code. In fact, I'll show you one more thing, not to keep talking about myself, but just to make the point. Right, so this is what I used to look like every day. As an example, just as an example. Share it, please. Go for it. Yeah.
Thank you, Nana. Joy requires stillness. Dukkha is the precondition, understanding, really feeling, living with, tasting, digesting, metabolizing. Dukkha is a precondition for joy. And you just told a story that started with yourself crying on the beach. And then you talked about insight after insight after insight. Where in the practice, in our daily practice, in our meditation practice, is it time for the crying on the beach? If I am sitting and I'm wrestling with my mind for a half an hour, maybe at 15 minutes, I decide to go do something else, cry, write in my journal, call somebody up, yell at the wind, whatever, and then come back to sit? Or do I stay with my sit and feel my wrestling mind? This has been a question for me for many months, and I'm glad to actually be able to articulate it. Thank you for your talk. It's helpful.
Thank you, Sherry. And before we go to Judith, so I wouldn't claim to have an answer, but may I offer some words? I think it's both. Because one may need help, or one does need help. So it's important to have the help of a community around you that's aligned, or professionals around, whether they're therapists or coaches and counselors and such, or spiritual advisors, what have you, to help. Very necessary. But what I found, and this may not apply to everyone, because I'm mostly introverted. I can't be extroverted, but mostly introverted, is embracing what, you know, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree is what Joseph Campbell, who talks about, you know, paths to awakening, right, talks about getting into hermit mode. Why hermit mode? Because there is no authority outside me. That's why the Buddha emphasizes our own efficacy, ehipasiko. Right? Whereas, you know, in Shia Islam, I'd have to go through an ayatollah, right, before I can get to God. However, the Buddha said, ehipasiko, find out for yourself. Don't believe anything I'm telling you. And the best way to find out is to have good instruction, but to sit with a discomfort alone, without any distraction, no prop. And that's the point of retreats or sitting, if we can put it a bit more plainly. But escaping stillness leads to more fragmentation. So maybe a personal bias. When I see people talking a lot or overly gregarious, I wonder, do they have space to actually see who they are? To know who they are. Why do I move my fingers like this? Why is my left finger like that? Why do I like to eat that? Why do I like ice cubes in my drink? Do you know, how does my left elbow function this way? Because to know thyself is the highest knowledge, ehipasiko. No wonder Plato, Aristotle, and Socrates also highlighted this. Because to know thyself, and to quote, requote Thich Nhat Hanh, as Sue's pointed to, he talks about the ocean. The drop is the same as the entire thing. So when I know myself, is to know the true nature of reality. And to know oneself requires sitting away from the distractions, or sitting with the distractions until the distractions are subdued by your stillness, and the energy and investigation to awaken. So people are necessary, but no, even twins can awaken for each other. But one has to follow one's own courses and conditions and karmic path to awaken. So maybe I was an insect in my previous life that was nice to the soil. So here I am. I'm here talking about karma. I don't know. But it's, for me, really paramount that one spends time with oneself without distraction, a deep interest in getting to know why my hair is like this, or why I feel this way, or why I like pistachio ice cream. And until one knows oneself so well, do you know how your kidneys function? Do you know why your liver does that? Do you know why you walk the way you do? Do you know your blood type? Do you know why you feel the way you do? Why you think the way you do? It is understanding and deconstruction that gives one the ability to understand what's without. But I found in my experience, at the time, I was more interested in what was outside. Whereas now I'm primarily interested in what's inside. So I'm rumbling a bit, but one just has to sit with what Dr. Cornel Wicks talks about, the stank. You know, he talks about the stank a lot. You got to sit with it and not be afraid of it, or be afraid of it, but still investigate until you realize, again, that the black cobra is just a black rope. That the first hour is inevitable. The second hour is a lot of hot sauce and sriracha and turmeric, I don't know. So staying with the first arrow and then understanding why the first arrow creates the stories from the second arrow is how the second arrow is weakened. So any interruption to that inquiry is a problem, in my view, or may require some boundaries from you to prioritize just being with oneself first. But that's my view. I don't know if it's helpful, but just sharing. Yes. What do you think before we go to Judith, Sherry?
I, what you're saying absolutely resonates with me. And also, I wonder for myself right now, if I have moments, I'm not talking about all the time, but if I have moments when I'm actually avoiding the dukkha by sitting still. That's, I think, and I'm not talking about being with other people at this point. I'm talking about, you know, if I'm too good at sitting quietly when really knowing the dukkha, really feeling it, really might be something more expressive. And I think the first thing that you said though about only I will know, right? It's, can you say the Pali again?
Ehi Pasiko, find out for yourself. Ehi Pasiko, yeah.
Yes, but all of your words have lots of resonance with me. Thank you.
This is it. I remember there was one point, if I may add, that I was trying to sit longer and I was talking to the teacher about it. And I can't seem to, I'm going from this number of minutes to that hour or whatever the thing is. And what happens? And is it sloth and torpor? Yes, it is sloth and torpor. Oh, sloth and torpor. Oh, a hindrance. Oh, that's what that is. And so leaning into what hindrance might be present, which is blocking the insight, is really the key. Not shying away from looking at the hindrance that is a block, and that becomes the portal. Yeah, because suffering is the portal. It's not an inconvenience. It is the portal. Mm-hmm. Suffering is not despite suffering, but suffering is. So, yeah.
Thank you,
Judith. Thank you for your patience. Yeah.
Thanks, Nana. Thanks for the talk. I was struck by the line in the email about this person said something about watching the narcissistic mind, right? And I realized I have been thinking of it as the delusional mind and the role of delusion in all of this. And of course, you know, obviously we have to deal with our own delusions. But recently I've been thinking about how do we deal with other people's delusions, especially the delusions of powerful people who don't appear to have any interest in even seeing through their delusions, even if they were even capable of it.
I love this a lot, Julia. This is a very wise perspective from someone who's been in trenches for a very long time. So this is a proposal, not an answer, right? It's a perspective. And this is informed a lot by two, maybe three people we all know very well, but I'll give you their names. I'll start with the first one, Gandhi.
Right.
So I watch the Gandhi movie maybe once a month, right? Once a month. And there's a particular scene in the movie where Gandhi and all these leaders are together talking about how do we get rid of the britches and so forth. And then Gandhi or Ben Kingsley's character says, well, we must see them off as friends. I'm like, see them off as friends? What is this poet talking about? This is poetry. See them off as friends. What is this Pollyanna-ish crap? And as I said, I watch it almost every month, if not every month. And as I started to understand the Dharma a little bit more, I said, this is what it means. So we can only give what we have. So if I'm giving you feelings of hatred, that is evidence of how much hatred I carry. Because I cannot be loving and offer hatred, right? So using the mirror effect from physics, when I look at myself so deeply, inevitably, when I engage with other people, because we are animals of energy, other people will pick up on that as well. And if you've seen yourself so deeply, inevitably, your presence forces other people to look at themselves as well. Because you are the world. So when Dr. Martin Luther King, for his frailty, said, we will not use violence. If you cannot be nonviolent, don't join the march. And why did he do that? Because nonviolence was a way to reveal the brutality of these forces so everyone would see that evidence. But that could only come from the restraint of an awakened mind that is ready to overcome the vicissitudes of hatred with infinite love, not naivete. So being able to withstand, this is Lojong in the Tibetan tradition of Mahayana, Vajrayana. Lojong, that I will take on your stuff, your crap, right? Because as a bodhisattva, not because I'm a people pleaser, but because it reduces greed, hatred, and ignorance. And in a way, when you think of that ahimsa, nonviolence, is very potent, but it's only in strategically and wisely practicing wholesomeness that unwholesomeness is revealed. And you have to remember that the world is the way it is because of all of us, right? And because we are unwholesome, so that the unwholesome actions keep going, because who's going to call me out? You know, as the Christians would say, he or she or they who's without sin, throw the first stone. You can't, unless you are blameless.
Right, and if you're blameless, you don't want to throw the stone.
And if I don't want to throw the stone and I'm resolute in my blamelessness because I know it ends suffering, then your brutality becomes very pronounced and obvious to you. And well, that crumbles your delusion.
Yeah, it has occurred to me that of all of the people suffering in the world, the perpetrators may be suffering the most.
So here it is.
Yeah.
There was an Italian theorist called Albert Memmi. And I don't want to keep going on. We can go off another hour, and I know we're coming up with time. Right. Albert Memmi wrote a book called The Colonizer and the Colonized. revealing what you just said. Because for me to dominate you, I have to go through that false little self that's invalidated and create a false self and create the adrenaline and the oxytocin and the cortisol in me that comes and says, yeah.
Right.
And then you feel that. But you don't know what I look like when I get home and I'm sitting on the bed, exhausted. So let's not get too enamored about how narcissism is the portrayal of a false self. The true self is love, awakening, doing no harm. And the false self is illusion, Maya, designed to make you think it is the real self.
Mm-hmm.
So the strength is remaining blameless and the perfume of blamelessness by looking at one's shadows and ending one's internal suffering. That ends the suffering without. So that when these deluded entities come your way, their delusion is revealed to them. It becomes obvious to them. Of course, what I'm saying requires, and I know this is a very advanced question, Judith, but it requires that one has spent a lot of time, to Sherry's point, looking at oneself without fear. That's how one becomes ennobled by the Four Noble Truths, in my limited view. Ennobled. Or what I like to say in a secular way, one becomes a spiritual gangster. Do you see?
Yeah.
My dear sister Judith. But this is just Nana talking. So thank you so much for your attention and your contributions and your energy. So now we come to merit, and I'll ask if there's anyone you want to offer merit to. You can either put the names in the chat or unmute yourself very quickly and let us know who you want to offer merit to. Just probably wait about 30 seconds for that. Then to all the nameless people that we are offering our merit to, may the merit of our practice this morning be shared by all beings so they may be free. Remembering that our work is never for ourselves alone, may we be safe and protected from harm. May you and all beings be safe and protected from harm. May we all be safe and protected from harm. So this is the message for today. I want to thank you again. And if you want to unmute and share some joy, throw in some joy before you get on with the other parts of your day, you can do so. And I just want to thank you for your kindness and your attention. And hopefully you're leaving thinking about joy in a way that sparks your own practice or accelerates joy for you in some way, or continues the joy that you're already propagating in the world. So thank you.